Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Today, we give you the full story of the case of the man accused of killing Kate Steinle on the waterfront in San Francisco on July 1st of 2015. The climate was highly charged as Donald Trump had begun his presidential campaign themed on immigrant bashing. And they seized on the case, demagogued it. And today we're going to meet the public defenders who won acquittal for Jose Garcia Zarate. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. And let's thank Willem Gruters in Holland. He's a longtime supporter of this podcast and just renewed his annual subscription. And so did Candace Brunlinger. I'd like to thank them along with Natalie Reel and Jason Spitzer, longtime supporters of this podcast. I invite you to join them. Go to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, you land on the sign-up page, and in minutes you can find a level of subscription that fits your budget. July 1st, 2015 was a beautiful day along San Francisco's waterfront. Jose Inez Garcia Zarate was sitting on the dock of the bay.
I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
Garcia Zarate had recently been released from the San Francisco jail, and he had been transferred there from a federal lockup in Southern California. He was an undocumented immigrant with a string of felonies, mostly related to being undocumented in the United States. And while he sat on that bench, he discovered underneath, we believe wrapped in a cloth or a T-shirt, what we discovered, it became apparent, was a gun. And a single shot was fired from that gun. It ricocheted, and it hit Kate Steinle, a young woman who was strolling along the dock of the bay with her father and a friend that day. And this became a case of national controversy. It was heavily charged, and it was demagogued by national political figures and by local leaders in San Francisco. Joining me today to talk about it are two men who defended Garcia Zarate. Francisco Ugarte is the deputy public defender and head of their immigration unit. Thanks for being with us, Francisco.
Thank you so much.
And Matt Gonzalez is a longtime figure in San Francisco. He's worked in the public defender's office. He took a little time off to serve on the board of supervisors, where he rose to the presidency of the board. He ran for mayor of San Francisco. He also was the vice presidential running mate of Ralph Nader's independent candidacy in 2008. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Peter.
And it's nice to talk with you about this important case. And I just happened to run into you at an art gallery opening a few weeks ago. And I'm glad that you agreed to come and talk with us today. First, I want to talk about the climate that was in effect both locally and nationally when you took on this case. Because Donald Trump had descended the escalator and made his really insulting and offensive comments about immigrants to kick off his campaign. And so, Francisco, that created a layer of tension and attention that made this case a national controversy.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting looking back. This case is important, I believe, in the historical development, recent politics and recent historical development of this country. And if you recall, when Donald Trump, you know, announced his candidacy for president of the United States, he talked about Mexicans as rapists and murderers, and they're coming here to do harm, and we need to do something about it. And at that point, he was essentially, you know, laughed off the stage. There were a few people who really loved that message, but for the most part, people didn't think he was a serious candidate based on the statements that he was making. And a week later, people... And forget about this, but a week after that, Dylann Roof shot African-American men and women in a church in South Carolina, and suddenly that was the national story that people were talking about. And people essentially forgot about what Donald Trump was talking about and started talking about this problem of racism that we have in this country. And that was the national narrative until the shooting of Kate Steinle. And if you really evaluate that next, you know, incident, Donald Trump started rising, and Donald Trump's racist narrative became justified based on this shooting. And suddenly we had a case where the incident itself was not the controversy. The controversy was an undocumented person with prior felony convictions accused of shooting a white woman in San Francisco, and Donald Trump and others exploited the worst fears of all of us and divided our country and our community on the base of class and race. And ultimately, the reason this case was so high profile is because of racism, because of the racial dynamics of the case. But then, you know, as we'll talk about, when you look at the actual facts of the case, Mr. Garcia Zarate's race, his immigration status had nothing to do, was not a motivating factor in any sense of the word of what happened. And it was ultimately found to be a tragic accident. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Matt, I don't know if you have any
thoughts
on
that. Well, Matt, I'd like you to comment on the San Francisco scene. Because, you know, people across the country know how Trump tried to demagogue this and exploit it. But there was also a struggle underway between Mayor Ed Lee and Sheriff Ross Mercurimi. And Ed Lee had been trying to get he tried to fire Mercurimi as sheriff, and that failed. And so when this opportunity came up to further demonize Ross Mercurimi over what was seen as a failure to properly execute the sanctuary city ordinance, this was a blood battle on the local scene as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think there might have been more support for our sheriff if there hadn't already been this, in effect, battle going on with him. So the establishment had weighed their options. They considered recalling him, but that's costly, and they decided they would just sit it out till he was up for re-election and defeat him at that time, which they did. Mm-hmm. So I do think that as a result of that, that, you know, conflict going on, you know, there wasn't the response to the Trump narrative and the conservative narrative that might have otherwise been there. Mm-hmm. You know, to my mind, the way the Sanctuary City issue got teed up wasn't very logical and compelling. And I don't think even Mercurimi did a very good job of explaining his position, although, you know, he was at least out there talking to whoever would listen. Mm-hmm. You know, and his narrative was like, hey, look, I've talked to the federal authorities. They know they have to get a warrant. They didn't have a warrant. so I don't know. It's not my fault. That was basically what he was saying.
And let me just insert a little context here, that Garcia Zarate had been released a couple of months prior from a federal prison term, and he was sent back to San Francisco based on really a bureaucratic snag or oddity, because there was an outstanding warrant from 19 years prior for a $20 beef over some weed. Is that accurate?
I think it was a marijuana sale. It wasn't even a beef. It was probably just a sale case that he'd been arrested on about 20 years earlier.
Right. And so the DA in San Francisco said, this is a joke. We're not going to prosecute that. And at that point, the sheriff's office had no reason to continue to hold him. Is that correct?
That's correct. The way Sanctuary City plays into it is sort of twofold. One is the general sense of Sanctuary City is that you see this among people on the left who like the idea that the local authority or the state can defy federal authority when you have a president that you don't like Donald Trump. I mean, I think we all like that kind of fundamental narrative. Unfortunately, I don't think it's the right narrative, because it feeds into the conservative sense that you have these renegade cities, when in fact, I think the proper narrative is that because municipalities are going to be responsible for the decision of whether or not to detain someone, the municipality, and I mean civilly liable when they detain citizens by mistake, they have to be very careful about this. There was a study, I think it was Northwestern University and National Public Radio, two separate studies that came up with, I think it was 1,500 citizens had been detained by mistake in a 10-year period. As a result of these kinds of errors, when you just leave it to ICE and Homeland Security to basically make a phone call and say, detain that person, the federal courts have instructed municipalities and the federal agencies, they basically have said, you have to go get some kind of probable cause. There has to be a probable cause determination that somebody is not here legally before you can detain them. In effect, they're saying we need some kind of court oversight on this imprisonment decision. And so rather than saying Sanctuary City debate is about the municipality defying federal law, it's actually the municipality following federal law. It's the federal agencies that want to defy their own federal courts because they don't want the added layer. Now, the second part of the Sanctuary City discussion with Garcia Zarate is, I don't think this particular instance was a very was really about Sanctuary City in my mind, because the federal authorities had possession of Garcia Zarate. They could amend a pre-existing deportation order and send him back to Mexico now that he had finished his federal term for illegal reentry. So when they bring him to San Francisco and they give him to the San Francisco authorities, their expectation that they will get him back in their custody, I don't think is an outrageous one to think that they should be entitled to get him back, because they were already in possession of him. It's different than your typical Sanctuary City scenario where the feds might suspect somebody's here without documentation or illegally, quote unquote, and they might say, hey, put a detainer on that guy. We want to research it and deport him if we can. You know, here they actually had possession of him. Mm-hmm. So I do think it was a mistake.
Now, the other piece of this here is the local media. And the San Francisco Chronicle, owned by the Hearst Corporation, is the dominant local newspaper. And they sided with Mayor Ed Lee in trying to use every means available to get Ross Mercurimi to resign or to terminate him as sheriff. And they, of course, position themselves as not a supporter of Trump, but they straddled this in a way to pander to the victim mentality and to the idea that it was Mercurimi who had screwed up. And I think that created just another layer of disinformation that really was part of this whole package. Francisco?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of the Chronicle, unfortunately, you see that whether it's the last 50 years, 75 years, or the last 10 years, they have really fomented anti-immigrant hysteria in San Francisco.
Well, and just
nationally.
On that note, can I underscore your comment? Because on the anniversary of the 1906 earthquake, they republished the front page of the Chronicle, and there was a Yellow Scare headline on the front page of the Chronicle on that day in April in 1906. So, yes, the history is rich.
So about 4 years or 5 years before the Garcia Zarate incident, there was another tragic death, and that is a Bologna family in San Francisco. And that case was somewhat similar to the Garcia Zarate case in that the alleged perpetrator was an undocumented person who had previously been in juvenile custody in San Francisco and was not turned over to ICE. There were a lot of complications in that story. But there was a journalist named Jackson Vanderbecken who wrote, I believe, seven articles, front page articles in the San Francisco Chronicle talking about sanctuary policies in San Francisco causing the death of the Bologna family, whipping up a hysteria about how San Francisco sanctuary is a sanctuary for criminals. And those stories motivated Gavin Newsom at the time to reverse policies, longstanding policies, saying we're not going to send children to ICE because of a juvenile justice issue. And as a result of those articles from the Cron, Newsom and others shifted their policies and said, this is not a sanctuary for people who commit criminal offenses. And I believe the statement was, we report, we don't deport. And so imagine what that means. Well, yeah, we actively collaborate with immigration enforcement. And so the Chronicle, you know, the early story, the focus was not what actually happened on the pier. The story was an undocumented immigrant is responsible for the death. If that person wasn't here, Kate Steinle would be alive. And so we have this causation argument as opposed to criminal liability argument. That's what people are talking about. And once you start talking about who someone is, what their race is, what their ethnicity is, what their immigration status is, as a cause of a crime, then we've fallen into the trap of racism and prejudice. And that's the thing that unfortunately happens over and over again. A crime is committed. You look at who the person is versus what actually happened. And that is, I think, we're all responsible in this country for contributing to that kind of racist narrative. So.
And Matt, the just baseline narrative, the who, what, when, where, the facts of the case were muddled by the initial coverage. And when you came forward with your defense theory that this was an accident and that you believed you would be able to establish that at trial, you know, they acted like you just got off a flight from Mars.
Well, for sure, you know, Francisco and I were talking about on the way over here when I first got assigned to the case, so to speak. I'm the chief attorney of the public defender office, but the elected public defender, Jeff Adachi, and I spoke and about the need to assign this case to one of our lawyers. And I made some suggestions of who might do the case. And he asked me to do it personally, which I, of course, said yes to. At the time, the only thing we knew was that we had a multiple-time deported felon from Mexico who had shot a woman at point-blank range multiple times, and he had confessed to it, and that his statement was already being, you know, it was streaming online with one of the TV stations. When I started looking at the case, I mean, I watched the statement. I was out of town. I was back in San Francisco the next day, and I went to see the client. I started to get the sense that there were just things about it that didn't make sense. He didn't know Kate Steinle. He had no reason to do her any kind of harm. There wasn't a robbery attempt taking place. They didn't appear to have had any bad interaction. Embedded in his statement to the news media was, in effect, accidental occurrence narrative, wherein he laid out that he found the gun there. And at the arraignment, Jeff and Francisco and I began to say to the media, look, this very well could be an accident. It was too early to be able to prove that. But by the time the preliminary hearing rolled around, we called an expert, a ballistics expert, and we were definitely putting out everything we could to show that there was no longer dispute about this being a ricochet. The bullet was deformed on one side. Everybody agreed it hit the concrete pier before it traveled upwards.
And it was about 8 feet from the point of leaving the muzzle?
About that, yeah.
When it ricocheted?
10 or 12 feet, yeah.
Okay. And then the bullet ricocheted from there and traveled another 70 or so feet where it right. entered Kate Steinle's body.
Right, and it struck her in the lower back. Again, I mean, it's a totally freak occurrence that she died from it. She probably would have survived this gunshot wound, single gunshot wound, but for the fact that it hit this arterial vein. I mean, it's really just a tragedy what happened to her. And I think it did capture the imagination of the public because you have a young woman, prime of her life, beautiful smile, with her family in a public place, and you have the deported felon who's come back, counter-narrative that's very hard to defend. You know, the point Francisco made earlier, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about issues of causation because they're embedded in the notion of what it means when somebody says, this wouldn't have happened if he wasn't there. And that's what people are thinking as they try to judge the criminal culpability angle. One of the discussions Francisco and I had were that there are some counter-narratives out there where, quote-unquote, illegal immigrants have been in this country and helped avert crimes between citizen persons. So like a police officer who's literally in a shootout with a citizen gets saved by the illegal alien who mm-hmm. drives up in his car and pulls him into the back seat and, you know, he's wounded but, you know, survives, or the illegal alien who intervenes when he sees a young girl abducted by a citizen who's in all likelihood going to commit an assault of some kind.
Those stories aren't considered news on Fox.
Right, but they're truthful, and it's really fascinating when you start to even put those out a little bit. It kind of resets your brain. You know, I'll let Francisco take it from here, but I'll add one thing. During jury selection, I did try to say to people, I would say, well, let me ask you this. If you were traveling in another country and you got charged with a crime, would you want everybody to be talking about the fact that you were a foreigner, or would you want them to be talking about the facts of the case and whether or not you were guilty? You know?
Francisco Ugarte?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put my mind back in this situation where we realized we had a case, but the case was so much more than what actually happened. It was about the immigration status of our client. I want to talk a little bit about the specific facts, because when people start learning about what the facts were in the case, their eyes are open to what happened. This gun is a Sig Sauer P-239. Has a maximum capacity of 8 bullets. The magazine has a maximum capacity of 7 bullets. And the way this gun works is that in order to get the gun ready to fire, you have to pull the chamber back. And that, after pulling it back, it allows a gun to get into the, a bullet into mm-hmm. the chamber so it can be ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best things for the defense that happened in this case is that the police department, through its dive team, found the gun.
Right.
And when they found the gun was in single action, and it had 7 bullets in it. So we immediately found only 1 bullet discharge. There was a single shot. This gun doesn't have a trigger safety, a manual trigger safety. That means that no matter if anybody were to put pressure on the trigger itself, that gun would go off. There's nothing stopping the trigger from discharging. So we had that. We had the ricochet. And we knew that the gun was actually pointed at the ground at the time it discharged. We also knew, in terms of the divot where the bullet hit, there was no perfect straight line from the point of the gun to the divot to Ms. Steinle. And if you ask any ballistic expert, you can't predict the trajectory of a bullet after it bounces on a concrete floor. It's just virtually impossible. You get the best marksman in the world, and you say you get one chance with this gun to hit the concrete and hit this target. It's just not going to happen. It's remarkably unpredictable. And so...
And Francisco, can you also add where the gun came from?
I was just about to get into that. The gun itself happened to be a federal agent's gun. Mm-hmm. And this individual had been traveling from Bureau of Land Management through San Francisco with his family and kept a fully loaded gun in a backpack in the back seat of his car. It's right now that is a crime in California, to store a loaded gun in a backpack without putting it in a proper storage or you know, removing the bullets from it.
A lockbox, yeah.
A lockbox, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, the narrative immediately after the shooting was that our client stole the gun. There was absolutely no evidence that our client took this gun. In fact,
well, wait a minute. He's illegal. That's all you need.
Well, we discovered that there were 3 other auto burglaries at the exact same time this car owned by this federal agent was burglarized, and laptops, cell phones, credit cards were taken. It had the pattern of a group of people that were engaged in auto burglary. None of those items were found on our client. And so this federal agent who improperly stored his weapon essentially put the community at risk by doing this, and the gun ends up on the pier. One of the other things that I learned through this case, every single day someone dies in this country because of an accidental discharge of a gun. I had a Google alert on my phone, accidentally shot and accidentally fired. Hmm. Google alert for news articles having those terms together. Yeah. Every single day, I would get 4 or 5 hits from news stories around the country, Montana, North Carolina, law enforcement officers shooting their feet, people dying because of accidental discharge of a gun. It's this skeleton in the closet in our country as a result of the 300 million guns that are in circulation in this country.
And most of those incidents involve a good guy with a gun.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, this entire incident looked like an accident. It was an accident. And the narrative, the press, you know, we'd have met with all these reporters around this story. They just failed to grasp that reality.
Now, Matt, you've been trying cases for a long time here as a public defender. Is this the case where the disconnect between the facts and the media coverage was the greatest for you?
Well, I definitely have not handled a case that had this kind of media attention. We took the approach that at the preliminary hearing we would call this expert to try to counter the narrative that the media had run with, but it wasn't that successful. And as we got closer to trial, we realized that we sort of had to take a more aggressive approach in terms of getting our story out there. And Francisco and I actually published, I believe it was a total of 6 opinion editorials in the 5 weeks leading up to the trial. So, we wrote articles that were published and we could circulate to the media specific on things like Kate's Law, Sanctuary City, Bureau of Land Management, and auto burglaries. I wrote an opinion editorial just on Garcia Zarate's prior criminal history to explain why it really wasn't a very serious matter. I mean, literally, we took the offensive because when you have a quick interview, even with a journalist who's on your side or, you know, predisposed to at least hearing, you know, what you've got to say, you just can't fit, you know, 900 words mm-hmm. into that answer, mm-hmm. you know. And so it was very helpful to us to be able to say, hey, read this or take a look at that, or we wrote an entire piece on that. And slowly it felt like things were shifting. We also, it wasn't purposeful, but it had the unintended consequence, which was positive for us, that we asked the court to make a true name finding of Garcia Zarate. Up to that time, he was being called Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, mm-hmm. which was an AKA that the federal authorities had used, even though he had told them his true name, mm-hmm. and they knew his true name was Garcia Zarate. They still called him Lopez Sanchez for years. So we finally said, you know what? If that's his name, he's facing life in prison. Let him go to trial with his real name.
Yeah.
But the effect of it was now if you Googled Garcia Zarate, all those Lopez Sanchez stories didn't necessarily come up. Hmm. And so we kind of got a reset button mm-hmm. close to the eve of trial to kind of re-present the case. And, you know, I think it was effective.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of layers of complexity in the press. What was striking to me was how poor the national press was on the case, whether it's not Washington Post, New York Times, and then we have Fox and CNN. The local reporters started figuring this stuff out. And if you look at the Examiner, Michael Barba, Alex Emsley from NPR really did a lot of good work on this case, yeah. KQED.
Tim Redman,
Vivian Ho, Noella Sawyer. Mm-hmm. The local media started accurately reporting some of these inconsistencies in the national narrative, didn't really trickle up to CNN, didn't yeah. really trickle up to Fox News. And I think one of the reasons that there was uproar about the verdict was because the national media wasn't doing its job. It yeah. wasn't telling the story of what actually happened.
And Francisco, yeah. specific to the priors, I've heard Sean Hannity, you know, just repeatedly say this guy had 5 or 6 felonies. And when you actually look at his prior convictions, most of them were for repeatedly trying to enter and live in the United States, and the others were for drug violations. There was no violent criminal history. But when the average Fox viewer hears 5 or 6 felonies, they think that those are you know, attempted murder or burglary with a gun. They think the worst based on what they see on television.
Yeah. Mr. Garcia Zarate had no violent criminal history whatsoever. It's accurate. He had a few felony drug possession cases from Tacoma, Washington in the early 90s at the height of the drug war, including one conviction where it appeared to be some kind of purchase, whether he was purchasing or selling, he pled to a drug sale. Mm-hmm. Now, the way our laws work is that if you're undocumented and you're convicted of what the federal government defines as a drug trafficking offense, which you or me, we would think, oh, well, that means you're selling a lot of, or you're manufacturing mm-hmm. or something like
that. Yeah, I got a barge over here.
So that includes very small time, you know, hand-to-hand sales. So mm-hmm. if you get deported and you come back, that's automatically a federal crime. It's called illegal reentry after deportation. It's a felony punishable by up to 5 years. And the average plea bargain in that case is about a year, maybe a little bit less.
Mm-hmm. You're talking 8 U.S.C.
1326. Correct.
No, that's not five maximum. That's 20 maximum.
But that's where there's a sentence enhancement.
No, so, that's if you've been deported for an aggravated felony.
Yeah, that's okay. Where I'm going. So okay. Just a common illegal reentry after deportation, you're looking at a five-year maximum. However, if you have an aggravated felony on your record, which is this small-time drug sale.
Drug trafficking is an aggravated felony equated with murder, rape, explosives.
Yeah. So he came back after he was deported. And suddenly the law changed in 1996, creating this sentence enhancement. He was charged with illegal reentry. Suddenly he's looking at 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he pleads to, I think, a 5 or 6 year sentence that first time. Gets deported after that. Comes back, tries to come back to the United States. Gets charged again. Illegal reentry, looking at 20 years. All based on this one drug offense.
Mm-hmm. From 1993, which... was what he suffered a conviction for the equivalent in California of a possession for sale, but basically the police saw a drug transaction on the street. When they stopped him, he had what appeared to be residue in a baggie, mm-hmm. no money on him,
mm-hmm.
probably the buyer, but he ends up with a possession for sale.
Hmm.
Really pathetic.
Now, I want to turn to your view of the prosecution. Because the outcome of the trial makes it clear that they overcharged. And we have testimony, or at least a column, that was written by an alternate juror named Phil Van Stockham. And he, I think, presented an interesting piece at Politico where he described, his experience and his idea about what, happened that was correct and what wasn't. And so it's very clear that they overcharged. But what else did the prosecution do that you felt was unfair, out of bounds, or gross misconduct?
Well, there were a couple of things that we didn't like very much. And I just want to say this. I think it's important to say, a lot of people, because Garcia Zarate was acquitted of the major counts, they celebrate this as an example of how you can get a fair trial in the United States. Garcia Zarate did not get a fair trial. There were a lot of things, a lot of judicial rulings in this case that were grossly unfair to him and attempts to assist the prosecution unfairly.
Give a couple of examples,
yeah,
please.
I would say, first off, we were on the eve of trial. There had always been this effort to suggest Garcia Zarate was the burglar. The prosecution had never divulged to us that they were aware not of a single burglary, but that single burglary was linked to other burglaries. So the one car was literally next to other cars broken into. Stolen items from the Bureau of Land Management car were discovered at the adjacent car where other things were stolen. What's significant about this is that Garcia Zarate did not have any stolen property from any of those burglaries in his possession. And after he was in custody, we learned that one of the victims of those auto burglaries had stolen property mailed back to her that presumably the real burglars didn't want anymore, didn't need, and kind of felt sorry that, hey, maybe you want these personal documents. So without question, Garcia Zarate was not the burglar. And they took the position that, well, since we're not going to try to argue that anymore, we don't have to give you this information. But, of course, they didn't have to argue it anymore because the media had already convicted him of that offense,
mm-hmm.
and that highly prejudiced our ability to defend the case. The prosecutor took the position that the Bureau of Land Management officer was irrelevant and should not testify. We subpoenaed the agent. We had to litigate because the BLM did not want to make him available for trial. We finally got the judge to agree that we could call him as a witness, but the judge prescribed a very narrow area of inquiry that literally less than 10 questions that he was going to allow. Fine, you take what you can get. We didn't like the ruling, but at least we were going to get to call him. Well, the prosecutor then decided, well, she was going to call him since we had finally won that battle. She put him on the stand. He was on the stand for probably an hour. He answered questions all, you know, about his training, how safety conscious he is, his trip to San Francisco.
The gun itself.
Blah, blah, blah. I got up to cross-examine, and the judge decided I was limited to his prior ruling of those, like, very few questions.
Really?
I tried to explain to him, Judge, you don't understand. This is cross-examination now. The area of inquiry is defined by what happened in direct exam.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't – you don't even have to go to law school to get this fundamental thing. He would not allow proper cross-examination. He must have sustained 30 or 40 objections when I tried to ask about things the agent had already testified to. The prosecution called a witness, John Evans. He was not qualified as an expert on ballistics. He's basically a CSI guy that went out there, measured the pier, and collected evidence. At the preliminary hearing, he had said there was no way that you could do any kind of trajectory analysis with this bullet and divot in the concrete because you just don't have even two fixed points. You don't know the exact location of the gun, the exact location of the deceased Steinle. I mean, you just couldn't do it. Well, now at trial, the district attorney offers his testimony. I object that he hasn't been qualified as an expert. The judge says, are you going to qualify him? She says, no. Okay. She starts asking him questions that require expertise. Over defense objection, the judge allows it. So even though he's previously written a report that says he can't do trajectory analysis, he testified under oath that he can't do it. He now is calling it vector analysis, and he basically says that it's a straight line from where Garcia Zarate was to where the victim was shot. And he also opined over objection, the judge allowed this, with no expertise, that the only way this could have happened was because Garcia Zarate aimed the gun towards her, pulled the trigger, and in fact shot her. We later learned, after he was off the stand, that there was a federal trial in progress, not trial, but proceedings, wherein Evans had been alleged to have, how to say it? I mean, he had previously interpreted a study done in the police department crime lab about the direction in which shell casings go when a gun is fired, completely inaccurately, opposite to what the study in fact showed. And the allegation in that lawsuit was that Evans testified that way on purpose to try to assist the prosecution. I mean, this is clearly a witness that would say anything to assist the prosecution. The prosecutors were aware of that lawsuit. They didn't feel they had an obligation to tell us about it. They did not make any of that testimony available to us. We later obtained it. We tried to strike his testimony. When we called our ballistics experts, the former head of the San Francisco Crime Lab, he was not allowed, because of an objection that the judge sustained, to testify that from his viewpoint that the facts being what we know them to be, that this was likely to be an accidental discharge of a firearm. We called a second expert, Canadian former Royal Mounted Police officer with a lot of experience investigating accidental discharges. The judge again sustained objections, not allowing him to testify in the exact manner that he allowed a non-expert to testify the opposite way.
Wow.
I had to just look at him and say, you know, he is going to answer this question. Basically saying to him, I'm going to keep asking this question till it's allowed because, you know, you allowed Evans to testify this way, and the judge decided to allow the answer on, like, the third try. I mean, he got it.
And name the judge, please.
Samuel Fang.
And how did you keep your cool? I mean, well, just what you described,
that last moment,
my temper is building.
In that last moment, it's not negotiable. It's like, okay, you've already disallowed proper objections with their expert. You've disallowed our expert from testifying. We have a second expert, and you're still making these ridiculous rulings. And, I mean, Francisco can tell you. I mean, I just looked at him and said, he is going to answer this question. I mean, you allowed this of Evans. Either strike that testimony or allow this one.
Did he threaten you with contempt?
No. I mean, you know, not in that instance. But, you know, I don't even know what to say. I mean, the examples I've given you are not even all of them. Mm-hmm. Garcia Zarate was not given a fair trial. When you really look at the limitations on cross-examination and things like that.
Francisco?
It's remarkable how many examples we can provide to you that we believe are examples where the judge did not give our client a fair trial. I handled the pretrial hearing involving the admissibility of Mr. Garcia Zarate's statement to the police. In the United States, we have a constitution and the right to remain silent. And if someone is in custody and they tell the police, they express an intent, they don't want to talk to you about the crime, the police have to stop the interrogation. If they continue, the statement is excluded. So the interrogation happened late at night, started about 1 in the morning, went till about 6 in the morning. And it was conducted in Spanish mostly. There was an interpreter who wasn't a professional interpreter. A police officer was certified in Spanish and was a native Spanish speaker. But interpretation skills, just because you're a native Spanish speaker and you can speak English as well, doesn't mean you're a qualified interpreter. It takes a significant...
Claro, que sí.
So in this case, in the very beginning of the interrogation, the police officers literally ask him, do you want to talk to us? We're going to come back. Do you want to talk to us? And he said, no. So they ignored that, left the room, came back, started giving him a Miranda warning. An individual is entitled to know that they have a right to remain silent. The Miranda warning was literally mistranslated. Mm. You have a right to wait in silence. Do you understand that? Okay, so what does that mean? You have a right to wait in silence. No, I have a right to remain silent. So they also never asked him to affirmatively waive his rights. And unfortunately, the law is so bad on Fifth Amendment issues nowadays that the police can go ahead, tell you what your rights are, and never ask the question, knowing that you have these rights, do you want to waive it? You don't have to ask that. Anyhow, that's neither here nor there. But during the course, about 2 hours into the interrogation, our client, Mr. Garcia Zarate, literally did not want to talk to them. It was pretty clear. He kept on saying, I am not going to answer your questions anymore. He started putting his hand on the table. No, you want me to use words. I'm not going to use words. You keep on asking me these questions. I already told you I'm not going to answer your questions anymore. That's for the judges. Mm-hmm. He literally said, that's for the judges to decide. That's for the courts. 4 or 5 times he made these statements in Spanish. He wanted to stop the interrogation. That is a clear invocation of the right to remain silent. This judge unfortunately ignored that, mm-hmm. said, well, I'm going to admit the statement.
You know, I'll say this. I mean, the thing about the statement is if you're going to admit the statement, okay, you're going to admit the statement, but there is another statement that the judge then decided he was not going to allow the jury to hear, that we were asking him to allow to hear because there were some inconsistencies that shed light on why some of the things he said in the first statement were clearly not accurate. This was the interview with one
Channel
of the
7.
News, yeah, ABC mm-hmm. 7, and the judge decided he didn't want that in because the DA didn't want it. I'll give you another example. The DA suggested she was going to ask that the jury be allowed to dry fire the gun to feel the trigger pull. We said we fully concurred in that. The judge said, okay, he was inclined to allow it. Okay, good, we've got an agreement on that. The DA withdrew that request. Now we made the request that she was objecting to. The judge now changed his mind because the prosecutor didn't want it. These were the kinds of rulings we were getting. And now the judge was taking the position that, oh, it's not safe. It's not safe to have a jury handle the gun. What are you talking about? It's not loaded. You can have an expert. I mean, it's just – I can't even start to try to help explain irrational decisions like that. And, you know, at the end of the day, if the jury had any doubt about the trigger pull of this gun, they would probably lean in our favor because she literally – I mean, the judge allowed testimony by a prosecution expert that suggested a 5-pound trigger pull was by like a trigger pull like lifting a 5-pound bag of sugar. It's like, actually, that's not true.
Yeah.
Our expert, we asked him to test the trigger pulls on some squirt guns, and he came back and said, yeah, I mean, I'm finding the same trigger pull on these squirt guns as the Sig Sauer in single action mode. I mean, you barely touch the thing, it can fire. But to try to mislead a jury with this notion of, you know, 5-pound bag of sugar, it was very misleading.
Mm-hmm. Have you had other encounters with this same judge, and is his behavior consistent?
He is an incredibly friendly, kind man in terms of his personal demeanor, which I have learned over the years is not going to change my opinion about the quality of trial that Garcia Zarate received.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a perfectly friendly person to have a beer with and watch a ball game with, and I'd have a very nice time doing it. But I would not want him to preside over a trial in a case of mine ever again.
Mm-hmm. Would you move to recuse him from a case?
I would.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's the thing. You just can't – you got to call balls and strikes. And the balls and strikes can't change because the prosecutor changed their mind about something.
Yeah, the strike zone should be the same.
Yeah, and, you know – and I just felt that, you know, we offered experts. They were qualified experts. The DA conceded they were experts. The judge designated them as experts. And then he's trying to disallow them from giving expert testimony on a key issue that he has improperly allowed, in effect, a lay witness with no qualifications who is committing very close to perjury, if not perjury, to go from you can't do trajectory analysis to now inventing a new kind of trajectory analysis called vector analysis that he's never used prior to taking the stand and talking about it. I mean, this is just not mm-hmm. – you know, I think the jury got it and they did the right thing.
Now, as the case went to the jury, Matt, what was your feeling? Did you think that you had well, first of all, it does appear that the prosecution overcharged, and that created a lot of concern among the jury members. But did you have confidence that they were going to acquit on the major charges?
We were hopeful. You know, after you get a favorable verdict, it always seems as if it was destined to be that way. If you lose a verdict, you're the only lawyer that could have lost it is often how you feel. I think we were hopeful. We thought the trial had gone in relatively good for us. We were very concerned about the testimony of this police officer who was allowed to give this, you know, pseudo-scientific testimony
mm-hmm.
and things like that.
The jury actually asked for a readback of his testimony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, also some of the outside influences. You know, the jury's very aware. The family's been in the courtroom several times, the media attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just can't shake those outside influences. How did you feel, Francisco?
Yeah. Francisco, what was your attitude going into?
You know, the case, I think Matt would agree, went in as well as we could have expected in light of the rulings that we saw.
Well, you had to be very clear that a first-degree murder charge couldn't be sustained by the evidence presented.
Obviously, it was the bad decision by the prosecutor, but at the time, you're thinking, wow, you know.
This is a circus.
This is a really scary moment because they're going for a first degree in this very first time in the entire case.
And think about it. I mean, first degree, you're arguing because you're able to say he had a gun, he sat there waiting to shoot this woman. And from their John Evans's testimony, he pointed the gun and fired directly at her, and it went in a straight line. The jury had not heard any impeachment of Evans related to his federal case. Mm-hmm. So that's very powerful evidence when you've got the suggestion that he's the burglar, he's got the gun there. He's taken a peculiar fixation on her, looking toward her in a photograph before the shooting. You know, it's this kind of cast, this spell that's being put out there that, you know, it's a purposeful shot.
Mm-hmm. If you take the immigration element out of it, the racial dynamics in the case, the hysteria around it, the facts itself are quite favorable in a homicide. Mm-hmm. Type case. It's actually factually a stronger case for the defense, however extraordinarily tragic it was. But with all of the pressure that everyone was under, and then this decision to go to the first degree charge, and then having this Officer Evans testify essentially that it was an intentional murder. You know, it was worrisome, but I think we felt confident that we did a really good job on mm-hmm. the case, that the jury had the tools necessary to find a not guilty verdict, and that is what happened. You know, one other detail on the statement before I forget. One of the things that we did and this was really Matt's brilliant idea, is because the interrogation was in Spanish, there was a written translation of the interrogation. So if you didn't speak Spanish, you had to follow the interrogation along in Spanish. And the way a transcript works is that there are two columns of the transcript. The left-hand column is the actual words spoken by the police officer, the interpreter, and the defendant in their native language. And then the right-hand column is the translation of those words. But what happens is that if a statement is made in English on the left-hand column, the statement will be repeated in English on the right-hand column. And that's how it looks. So when you look at a transcript, everything looks like it's in English, and if you just follow the right hand without looking at your Spanish side, you just follow a nice English version of what happened. What we did is we realized that the police interpreter was not translating everything accurately. But if you looked at just the right hand column of the transcript, it looked like everything, it was quite seamless.
Yeah.
So what we did is that we created a transcript that essentially bolded only the Spanish words spoken, only the dialogue between the interpreter and Mr. Garcia Zarate. So it turns out that the word trigger, which is such a critical piece in the case, did you pull the trigger, that was never translated to Mr. Garcia Zarate accurately. It was translated, did you fire the gun? To which he said yes. The police officer said, did you pull the trigger? Was your intent to pull the trigger? Did you fire the gun? And you fired the gun, right? Yes. So how do you highlight that for a jury when you're just looking at a transcript and it all looks like he answered the question, did you pull the trigger? Yes. Well, Matt said, let's get that English stuff out, because he wasn't understanding that English dialogue. Let's just use the Spanish language. And so we had an interpreter, an expert in interpretation, that testified during the trial and said these words weren't translated accurately. And I think that was an important piece to help the jury understand that this statement wasn't all what mm-hmm. the prosecutor wanted yeah. them to think.
So the jury acquitted on first degree, second degree manslaughter, but they curiously found him guilty of a felon in possession of a gun. And you went into, I believe, post-trial proceedings where you showed that the evidence at the trial showed that he wasn't in possession of that gun. He may have handled it momentarily, but you basically parsed the term possession. Is that right?
Well, we were aware that the jury had asked a question while they were deliberating about how long you have to be in possession of something to be in possession of it. That's a real tip-off. It occurred to me at that moment that they were struggling with a real technical conviction, which was, okay, if we believe he did not knowingly, that he did not bring the gun to the pier, if we believe he found the gun on the pier, if we believe it was wrapped up in something and he didn't know what it was, and as he's unwrapping it, it fires. Okay, we're with you all the way through that. But now that it's fired, he knows it's a gun, it's in his hands, and the split second before he can drop or throw the gun, is he in possession of it, and do we have to convict him of that? That's in effect what they were asking.
Mm-hmm.
The judge would not give an instruction related to momentary possession, and the instruction, I think, would have assisted the jury in understanding that if he wasn't trying to possess a firearm and should not be convicted of it. The analogy I used for the court was that if I handed the judge an envelope, the contents of which he was unaware of, he opens the envelope and it has contraband in it, and he immediately sets the envelope down, is he guilty of possessing that contraband? Well, of course not. That would mm-hmm. be stupid mm-hmm. to say, you know, that's a gotcha conviction. And so we think that that conviction won't withstand appellate review,
mm-hmm.
but it did cause a lot of confusion for the media. And, you know, a lot of the commentators just could not understand because they took the possession conviction as if he must have knowingly carried a gun to the pier, and that's not the case.
The alternate juror wrote, the jury members were not free to select the crime. They had to use the one chosen by the prosecution, and the prosecution chose that crime to be the, quote, brandishing or waving with menace of a weapon. As a juror, I found this choice puzzling because the prosecutor presented absolutely zero evidence of brandishing during the trial. I don't think we even heard the word brandishing until it was read as part of the charge during jury instructions at the trial's end. That's quite revealing.
Yes, it is. It's a technical point because the prosecutor wanted to use a definition of brandishing which appears in the jury instructions as an enhancement to another offense. We argued to the court that no, she has to pick a misdemeanor and the jury has to find all of the elements of the misdemeanor to be true. That's just what the law is.
Mm-hmm.
So she stuck with brandishing, even though she conceded, in the pretrial discussion. I mean, we told her she couldn't prove it, and she said she couldn't prove it. But she made that point to get the judge to give her the brandishing enhancement that she wasn't entitled to. So the whole thing was, comedy of errors. It was really just culmination of
mm-hmm.
error.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason ultimately she didn't sort it out properly was she was confident she would get first or second. So she just – it was like whatever. You
mm-hmm.
know, this is – I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because I'm going to get him a first or second is
yeah.
I think what she was thinking.
So then we saw the federal government pile on, and the Justice Department has filed federal charges.
Yeah. You know,
is that right?
Yeah, Peter, let me just say one thing.
Sure.
Even though she selected the wrong misdemeanor,
mm-hmm.
they still would not have been able to prove criminal negligence. So the defendant, if you unknowingly pick up an object and it fires a bullet, you haven't by picking up an object, you haven't even committed ordinary negligence. So this idea that that they would have been able to make manslaughter, mm-hmm. even with the right misdemeanor, just FYI,
yeah.
to the point that you raised now, yes, he was convicted of gun possession. He had already served the maximum sentence. The federal authorities never prosecute somebody that has received the maximum sentence for gun possession in the state courts. They're doing it strictly because they don't like the outcome.
Yeah.
And after the verdict, they initially took the position that they were going to charge him with illegal reentry and things like that. But he didn't illegally enter the country this time. They let him go in San Francisco. So they when they realized they couldn't prosecute him for illegal reentry, they started coming up with, well, we'll go after him for mm-hmm. gun possession.
Tax evasion.
Yeah, right. Anything that they can get. But I think a properly instructed jury is going to reach the conclusion that our jury should have reached, which was, you know what, he did not know what this mm-hmm. thing was when he picked it up. That's yeah. not a crime.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, as we wrap up, Francisco Ugarte, is there anything you'd like to add that we didn't cover or impressions that you want to share with our listeners?
Yes. I think the story lost in this case is the life of Mr. Garcia Zarate and how he was homeless, how he left his country because of poverty, how he, developed some substance abuse issues, but ended up essentially institutionalized in the U.S. criminal justice system for the act of essentially walking from one place to another for 17 years. And I think the story should have been about how there are so many guns in this country and how someone who really needs services was just lost in our system. And it's a breakdown of our system that caused this situation to happen. And but when looking at him and his life and his experiences, that was really lost in this whole case. And I think, I'm extraordinarily proud to have represented him in this case, to have worked in this office at the Public Defender's Office, to have worked under Matt, and to be under the leadership of Jeff Adachi, because I think we were in a position because Jeff Adachi is an elected public defender, to really aggressively litigate this case and do what was necessary to change the narrative.
Matt Gonzalez, final thoughts?
Francisco mentioned something earlier that I think is worth kind of closing with, the whole what had happened to the Bologna family. This is basically a father and two of his sons were all shot and killed in what appeared to be a gang shooting. They were mistaken for gang, opponents or affiliates. And, I think people living in a city should be safe. I think that we should have public policy discussions about how we what we can do to be safe. And if somebody is here in the United States in a sort of undocumented status, I do think we have to process what the rules ought to be. In a lot of cases, we have clearly learned that simply when somebody has been accused of a crime, you can't suddenly decide that you're going to deport them, because those cases often fizzle out and there really nothing happened. The other thing is that it's important to keep in mind is many of the people that we think are illegal here, in fact, under old immigration laws, would be allowed to be here, because for years and years the immigration laws had built in amnesty, where after a certain number of years it was presumed that the statute of limitations to try to deport you had passed. You're here, you're law-abiding, you're paying your taxes, and that sort of thing. And so we're in a peculiar time in the United States where a growing population in the United States doesn't have legal status in the country. And, whether it's their children or kids that have been brought here at a very early age, and they're coming here to do work for Americans, American businesses, American employers. You know, it's a very complicated situation, and we just have to be careful that we can't turn in a criminal accusation, can't become an inquiry simply into immigration status. It has to be about what the facts were. And I go back to the point I made, you know, if you were arrested in a foreign country, would you want everybody talking about how you were a foreigner, you know?
Well, Matt and Francisco, thank you first and foremost for sharing the full story of the Garcia Zarate case. And also, I just want to thank you for being public defenders. You could be corporate lawyers making $1 million a year, but you are really on the front lines of the fight for human rights and for legal rights, including for those who aren't documented and those who aren't popular. And in the climate that you had to operate under, I just feel that you did remarkable work, and I hope that you will be proud of that for the rest of your lives.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Matt Gonzalez and Francisco Ugarte. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.